This will be an interview with Mike Freeman and Eddie Turner of Brush Fire, conducted by Jack Sorrells, October 17, 1985. And this tape will be in the SEBA archives.
All right.
So this is important stuff, guys.
We'll treat it seriously.
Yeah, hopefully what goes on this tape they can use for some basic background material on this feature article we're going to try to run on y'all in the December issue, the winter issue of the Cedar Breakdown. And I've outlined some questions here. If y'all are just kind of, if there's anything in here that I ask that you don't want to tell me, we'll just let me know and cut it out. I don't think it'll get that.
We have very few things to hide, but you know, I guess there's always something that somebody don't want to talk about.
Well, it might. I tried to stay away from any questions like that. I don't really think they're necessary, but it might be something in here anyhow that you may not want to.
I doubt it.
Say, but I'll start with asking you, Mike, what's your full name and the correct spelling of that name?
Okay. Full name, believe it or not, is Michael Merlin Fleming, but the Merlin is just as appropriately left out. M-I-C-H-A-E-L. M-E-R-L-I-N, Jack, if you got to put that down. Nobody knows that.
F-L-E-M-I-N-G?
Right. One M and no S. That's okay. Unusual. Everybody else.
Okay, Eddie, what's your full name and correct spelling?
God, I hate this. I'm not going to believe this.
It's starting off bad.
James Elliot Turner.
L-L-I-O-T-T. T-T. Turner.
Well, they got Eddie out of all that. I don't know.
And this is, I'll put Eddie in parentheses.
That took some doing.
And then in parentheses
and
from that.
Yours, you go by Mike most times.
Mike, yeah.
So,
yeah. Most Mike. Folks call me Duncan, but
what did your mama call you? That's what I mean. Okay, Mike, what is your relationship with Brush Fire? What instrument or instruments do you play? And what voice part?
Okay. I am a rhythm guitar player. That's my sole instrument. I switch off with Eddie on either lead or tenor. He and I carry those two parts, whichever's one singing, the other carries the balance.
Okay, you switch with Eddie.
Mm-hmm. We handle the tenor and lead between us and most everything. I do the majority of the booking for the band and the promotion as well.
Booking?
By default.
And promotion.
That's true.
Would you say that you're the band leader?
I'd rather not. I have been called that, and if you ask the other three, they might say that, but I would prefer not to be called that, Jack, to be honest.
Has been called band leader. Okay.
By default.
Purely by default. When I started with Eddie and Joe, and I'm sure you'll get into some of this, but they had both been in bluegrass and country rock bands for years, and I'd never done anything like that. So we're practicing the first few times. We actually get a job, you know, we got a place to play. And I asked the question, well, who's going to front this outfit, announce the songs and stuff? And they both look at me and say, you are.
Yeah. So you just kind of evolved into it, not by design particularly, but by your relationship with the whole group.
They designated me such.
Okay. He just fit the part, that's all.
Eddie, what is your relationship with Brush Fire, and what instrument do you play, and what role do you sing?
Mandolin player.
Mandolin. Okay.
Occasionally guitar.
Occasionally.
Very occasionally.
Not nearly enough.
Okay.
Tenor and lead.
Tenor and lead.
Just swap off with Mike.
Okay, swap with Mike. Do y'all have another voice on your group?
Yes, two more.
Two more voices. So you got full part voice.
Yes. That's pretty much the.
Has that been your style more or less?
It's been our basic style, I guess, more or less. We're more vocally oriented than anything else.
Mm-hmm. We do it. We don't do anything less than three part. We do, you know, majority stuff three with a lot of four part thrown in stuff.
Okay, what's the name of the current members of the band, and what do they play and sing? The other members.
Go ahead, you take one. I'll take the next.
Joe Partridge.
Mm-hmm.
P-A-R-T-R-I-D-G-E. Okay.
Plays bass.
Bass fiddle. Is it bass fiddle or electric?
Bass fiddle.
Bass fiddle. Okay.
And does all the baritone.
Sing the baritone.
Okay. Pretty much Joe's on the vocal part.
Okay.
Yeah. J. Richardson. J-A-Y.
J-A-Y.
Richardson.
Richardson.
Plays banjo and sings bass.
That's odd.
It is, isn't it?
Thing generally. But you know, most banjo players sing baritone. I don't know why.
Jay's a good baritone singer, too.
Yeah. He is a baritone singer. We made him a bass singer.
What Jay was before. But.
And Joe and Jay both. Well, really, without, you know, sounding too strange, Joe and Jay can both sing any part that's in their range. And Eddie and I can as well, you know, with just a little little practice. We do some different harmonies and things, but Joe as well can sing baritone, bass, or whatever he's
Who
called
Who else
upon.
Is with y'all band then?
Ted Lally.
Ted Lally, that's right. Mm-hmm. Ted, L-O-L-L-E-Y?
Mm-hmm. And Ted is, primarily he's our sound man.
Sound engineer?
Mm-hmm. Sound engineer. We call him road manager. He likes
road
that
manager.
Title.
Yeah, he handles a lot of the problems that maybe some of the other group doesn't want to handle.
Does he play?
He plays bass, and we do incorporate him to sing, not sing, but play bass on several of our groups.
We use him on stage.
Does he sing?
No.
What do you do? Swap out Ted and Joe?
Ted and Joe. We
on stage?
Or
are they ever both on stage at one time?
Yeah.
Yes,
strangely enough.
Joe's singing and Ted playing bass.
What we do is, once Ted gets the sound system set like he thinks it ought to be, it doesn't need anymore, then we'll call him up on bass for, I guess the best thing is to say that we call him up for some numbers, for selected numbers, to just let him get up and play some bass.
Does Joe leave the stage when he comes in?
No, Joe stays on the stage, baritone, stands there with his arms folded.
Oh, he does? He don't put anything in his hands then?
He should.
Like Bluegrass Incorporated takes a little drum?
No, I hope he never does.
He doesn't take a castanet or something like that?
We mostly just bring Ted on as a guest from, you know, on stage from time to time to let him get up. Joe is basically the bass player, and Ted may get up and play a couple of songs each set.
Okay, going way back, when did Brush Fire begin as a bluegrass band? About what,
you know, the year?
What year?
8 years ago.
Let's see.
What year was Stanley born?
77.
Wasn't that the year?
Yeah,
1977.
That's how I remember.
It was late 1977.
Is Brush Fire one word or two words?
Two words.
Okay.
It was originally one, and we discovered that there was another.
Stage fire, two different words.
Mm-hmm. We discovered that there was another band in Kentucky with the same name, and they used one word, so we changed it just
for that purpose,
to differentiate between the two.
Did you have anything particular in mind when you named it Brush Fire? And who named it that, by the way?
I think Mike's responsible for the name.
I came up with the name, but it had no particular meaning, you know, other than... I just like the ring of it. We were trying to come up with a name. When we get into, well, I guess you're talking about when we started, when there had been, Eddie and Joe had been playing together for several years. Brush Fires is really a continuation of what they'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to think of it that way because that's where I came in. But they had bands, one or more bluegrass bands before that. And had just not been able to keep the personnel.
Yeah, but they didn't use that name, Brush Fire.
No, in fact, when I first joined up, they were still using the name Pike Trucking Company. Right?
Right.
The original members then of Brush Fire, when you first formed Brush Fire, was it a full group? Or
five.
Who was the original members?
Okay, Mike. Joe. Mike Head.
What did he play?
And he played bass.
Joe played banjo up until just recently.
At that point. That's right. And a guy named Russell Owens. on dobro. And that was the original brush fire.
I don't know what picture
Mike,
Eddie did.
Joe, Eddie,
I've got
Mike,
several, but I bet you've got everything I've got.
That's the best one I could come up with off the original group. We didn't have any good pictures. And that group didn't last long.
And don't print that.
That's it.
That was a weird celebration we played, and the little funny costumes and the hats.
We were playing, playing on the courthouse in Newland, is where that is.
It was a good job, but somebody had to do it. And,
it was for a sesquicentennial.
Who was the band leader of the original group? Was Mike, were you still kind of the band leader?
Well, once I started, they gave me the title right off the bat. You know, once I started, you're going to do the talking and you're going to do all this stuff. They were the musicians, is what it amounted to. And I walked in that night. Just to give you a little background, they'd had a band, Pike Trucking Company, which had kind of fallen apart. They were having trouble keeping a guitar player. They'd have two or three, if what they've told me is correct.
Three at least.
They'd keep three on the payroll at any given time and hope one would show up. And it had just fallen apart again. And Donnie Lee, who was a friend of mine and also a friend of theirs, I happened to be working with Donnie, and he told me that he knew that I had gotten interested in the music. And owned a guitar at that point, and even today I'm a guitar owner. I don't claim to be a player, but I'm a guitar owner. And he had told me that if I wanted to play in a band, call Joe Partridge. He was putting the one back together. So I went home and called Joe, and Joe said, yeah, me and Eddie are going to do it, but we'll call you when we get ready. Well, a few weeks later, Joe called me up, said, we're going to practice tonight at Eddie's house. Come out and let's try out. So I had a Conn guitar. Conn. There ain't many of them floating around. And it was a good old guitar, but it was just cheap. Did not even have a case for it. Just throwed it in the car, drove out to Eddie's house with directions, and the three of us stood around and tried to see if it was going to work. And that was about 8 years ago this month, I guess.
That's right.
It's where we where it
this
started.
Time of year. That's correct.
Going way on back, Mike, what made you originally interested in bluegrass?
Well,
way back when you first delved into bluegrass.
Unfortunately, I've not been in it as long as a lot of the people, some of the other people in the band, and if not as long as I'd like to have been. I grew up hearing a lot of gospel music, a lot of country music, but didn't know what bluegrass was. And when I was in high school, I got into folk music and got my first guitar and was going to learn to play and learn all three chords that I needed to play folk music at the time. And that was what I was doing. Then, and I guess the early 70s, the Bullsboro Bluegrass Band was sponsoring a festival there in Newnan, where I live, and Joe was a part of that band at the time. And I had always been drawn more to acoustic music than to electric music. The electric stuff just didn't really interest me. Whoever was doing acoustic music at the time was what I was into after the folk music. So I started going to the Bullsboro Bluegrass Festival. And got familiar with Donnie and with Joe a little bit, and that was really my first exposure to real bluegrass music, to know what it was. Well, all I was doing at that point for several years was going out to the festival and then go home, and I wouldn't hear it again until the next year.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started work with Donnie Lee. I was actually working with the parole board at the time, but he and I were in different offices, and I didn't know him. And a few years later, I was transferred into the central office in Atlanta. I was commuting, riding back and forth to Atlanta with Donnie Lee. And he was playing tapes and just got me thoroughly caught up in it. And that
what
was,
type of early bluegrass music did you hear that made you really interested in bluegrass?
The first stuff that I heard was Stanley Brothers that I just loved. And still today, I've probably got close to 60 Stanley Brothers albums. And that's probably some of my favorite stuff. But that's what Donnie was playing for.
I guarantee that.
Stanley Brothers and the Seldom Scene is what he was playing.
Yeah.
And I just preferred the Stanley sound.
Yeah.
In those early days.
That banjo that Ralph's got is hard to beat. He just sounded a thing.
It caught me up. And the gospel music together.
What's the first instrument you learned to play?
I stick solely with the guitar, yeah.
And that was in about what year?
68. I was senior in high school.
68. Yeah. And it was an old Conn guitar?
Well, the first one was even worse than that. The first one I owned was a J.C. Penney's.
J.C. Penney guitar.
I ordered straight out of the catalog. That sounded like something out of the 1930s. But the first one I owned.
You went to a Conn, C-O-N-N?
Then I bought a Conn, C-O-N-N. It was a factory second. It had a flaw in the finish, and I bought it for $99 at a music store.
What kind of guitar do you have now?
Now I've got two Martins, a D35 and a D28. in the middle of all that, I had a Vega and another Martin, but that old Con.
The one you play now is a D-25, I mean D-28?
Yeah, I've got a 28 now.
Okay.
I also own an upright bass, which I don't play.
Eddie, what instrument did you first learn to play?
Guitar.
He's got a lot longer history than I do.
I was 13 years old. My Christmas present at age 13 was a Sears and Roebuck electric guitar.
Sears.
Remember it well. I'd love to forget it.
Silvertone.
The one, the only.
Did it have a separate amp, or did
yes,
it have the amp built in the case?
It had a 35-watt amplifier. I'll never forget it as long as I will.
When did you change over to a mandolin?
Several years later.
He's got a long history, Jack, that he ought to just stop and tell you about what all he did.
Go ahead and tell me the story of your musical career, Eddie. And instead of me trying to write it down, I let that tape take it.
Okay. There were several years after I first started learning how to play. Of course, I didn't know what bluegrass was. And it was several years later before I got interested in bluegrass. And I was primarily playing country and some old-time gospel. And I had a couple of friends that was interested in the music, you know. And me and a friend of mine, they needed help. And we was kind of learning along about the same time. And my stepmother and her family was musically oriented, and they had been singing old-time gospel music along with guitars and mandolins and things for a long time. So I'd kind of gotten into a little bit of bluegrass there, but primarily I was playing just country and western, and I started getting interested in bluegrass. And the first Boonesboro Bluegrass Festival that was ever held was then at the Coweta Raceway in Newnan, Georgia. And I stumbled on it by mistake, and we just seen a bunch of cars going down there, and knew there wasn't a race going on, and drove in down there one night. And here's all these people just standing out in the middle of the field with banjos and guitars and fiddles and everything. I thought, God, you know, this is great. Never seen anything like this. And that was my first meeting up with bluegrass music. Well, I didn't know Joe at this time. However, Joe was at the festival.
This is Joe Partridge.
So I come back home and I start saying, well, you know, that's what we're going to do. We're going to start us up a bluegrass group. So me and a couple of friends decided, well, we're going to all learn to play bluegrass instruments. So
this is a bunch of teenagers who already had a rock and roll band going.
I must have been 16 years old at the time. It couldn't have been more. So I knew some friends, or an uncle of mine knew some friends called the Cofields. He says, I'm going to take you over there to meet these guys, and they into bluegrass. They can tell you a little bit about bluegrass. So I got over there, and they says, well, I'm going to give you a guy's name and his phone number. If you really like bluegrass, this is the guy you ought to meet. Well, phone number he gave me just happened to be Joe Partridge. Never having met Joe, I called Joe up, and my stepbrother wanted to learn to play banjo. Well, Joe was playing banjo at the time with the Boonesboro Bluegrass Band. So I called Joe up, and Joe and Donnie Lee was playing bass for the Boonesboro Bluegrass Band at the time, came over to the house one night. Kind of got us started into bluegrass. You know, they brought a few records over, and I was just enthralled, you know. I'd never heard anything like this. I'd never been that close to anybody playing the banjo before, and it was exciting. So I played with a family group for a couple of years, playing bluegrass and a little country and western, what have you. Then Joe broke up from the Boonesboro Bluegrass Band, and I was still playing country at this time, still into electric guitar, so to speak. And I found out that Joe was a heck of a piano player, played Jerry Lee Lewis style, honky-tonk piano. So we needed a piano player, so I called Joe up, and Joe was not doing anything musically at the time. So Joe kind of just come on the bandwagon with us, and I played in the group with Joe for 2 or 3 years, I guess. I was playing electric guitar.
What was that group name?
That group was called Winning Ticket.
Winning Ticket.
Yes. And during the course of this
group,
yeah, country, basically country, some real soft rock and roll.
They was playing places that Eddie wasn't even old enough to be in.
That's right. We had to go in and ask permission for me to go in. You know, I'm about 17 years old around about this time, you know, and was doing the local Moose Clubs and the American Legions and what have you around the circuit by that time. So we had a few personnel changes, and the group was having some problems. So Joe one day says, I'd sure love to get back into bluegrass. I said, you know what? I was getting real interested in it there for a while. So I went to a pawn shop and bought a mandolin. It must have cost $39 most. So I went out and I strummed around on it, and I kind of got interested in it. And later on, about 2 months later, I went out and bought me a Martin mandolin. Well, I really thought I had something. Come soon to find out that I didn't. But,
so you had a good name,
yeah. Yeah, it's a good name, you know. They need to stuck the guitars, that's a personal opinion.
Yeah, I had a Martin Vega banjo one time. I gave it to my nephew.
So, Joe and I started picking a little bluegrass, and we'd had various members of some groups, and we never could really hold anything together. We must have rocked on going on a couple of years with this, maybe, at the most.
During this time, you was learning the mandolin.
I was learning the mandolin and played guitar a little bit. And we went through several guitar players. We had about three, like Mike said, on the payroll all the time, hoping one of them would show up.
Yeah.
You know, at the show. And we had a bass player. And we'd go in
the car. At this time, had you given up any? Had you given up amplifiers?
Yeah, we had. I had during this point gotten married for the first time, and I had sold all the electrical stuff. And so I've kind of gotten out of all that.
You're
I really
acoustic music.
Hooked on bluegrass, yeah. You know, into this thing. Yeah.
What type of bluegrass were you playing then?
Well, mainly traditional. Traditional bluegrass. Oh, we did a little country-flavored stuff there once in a while and kind of adapted it to bluegrass, but it was mainly just traditional type stuff. And the group had several personnel changes, and it wasn't rocking along too good, so Joe and I decided we would just fold the group. Wait a while and just reform the group, you know, after we found some people that were really interested, dedicated, really what we wanted. Mm-hmm. And I guess Mike's the first person that we brought in to the group. And that gives kind of where Brushfire started.
Insight into how Brushfire got started, really. That's kind of what we wanted.
We all, strangely enough, doesn't hold true today, but when we started, the three of us, which has always been the nucleus of this group. I don't want to take anything away from what they were doing before I come along, because they did have a good group, that just didn't carry on. But at that point, Eddie and Joe and I all lived within about 3-4 miles of each other. Well, about 5 miles of each other.
Real nice to get together and practice.
It was great. It was convenient, you know. I mean, everybody was
just...
You call up, and 10 minutes later, everybody could be over there and you're ready to play.
I guess that kind of answers who formed Brushfire and how was the name chosen and when. That was another question I had.
We give Joe credit for putting it together because he's the one that got Eddie into it. And the one
I guess
that
Joe was
in.
The father of the whole thing, if it's got to have a father.
Him and Eddie were the two that put it together. And then I joined next, and then we had another series of personnel changes until we could... I continued to have until
Joe was primarily responsible for the early organization of Brushfire, I guess you could say.
When did you, I know you must have played for several years before you got your own sound system. Did you not?
No, strangely.
You started out with your own sound system.
That's another story. Sound systems has been a story with this band. Eddie can tell you about it.
Well, after being with the country group and Joe and I playing together for a good while, I own the sound system, and that was the only thing that when we actually got into bluegrass that I didn't sell as far as electrical equipment went. So I kept the sound system. No one was going to need it. So.
Okay.
Lord forbid, but I'll tell you what I had would all fit in the trunk of a 1968 Plymouth. And did for a long time.
But you kind of evolved from that sound system into what Ted Lawley has got you
into what we have now, that you have to haul in two bands.
Who owns the sound system now?
The band
does.
Let me just go into that a little bit. When I started with them, Eddie had this Shure PA system, which functioned fine for us at the time. It was exactly what we needed. He owned that, and like you say, we hauled it around in his Plymouth. Everything that'd go in the trunk went in the trunk, and the monitors went in the back seat of a two-door Plymouth. We'd tie the trunk lid down, take off. After about what, 2 years into the group, I guess, we decided that we really needed another sound system if we was going to, and we didn't have any control over feedback or anything. We really needed another sound system. We was making a little money, and wasn't about to put any in our pocket. You know, we had to plow it all back into the group. So I went. I was working in Atlanta at the time. We never wanted to profit a dime. If we ever make any money, we'll quit. I was working in Atlanta. And
that rings true.
We know something wrong when we make a dollar, because there's got to be somewhere it ought to go. I was working in Atlanta, and the closest music store to my office was Clark Music on Ponce de Leon. Went over there during lunch one day and talked to some people that I had met there. Bob Donaldson was in the bluegrass. And I didn't know a thing about sound systems. Eddie knew some about it, but I knew nothing. I went in there and let him sell me a sound system and took them back up there that next Saturday, and we bought it. It was QSC amps. It was QSC amps and Bullfrog speakers and Tapco boards.
That's right.
And we thought we had something.
Mm.
And it was, I guess, a step up from what we had.
Right. It was the greatest
thing. We used that system. Ted was not with us at that point. Eddie was a sound man. Eddie was a mandolin player, and he ran a sound man soundboard from the stage while playing mandolin and singing.
So you know, we didn't have one.
But we thought we had a sound system. Well, about 2 years after we bought that one, we went to Columbus. One Friday, we were playing at Country's Barbecue in Columbus, filling in for the regular band there. And that must have been 81.
Yeah, that's got to be pretty close.
I think it was 1981, winter of 1981. We went down to Country's Barbecue, set up our sound system on Friday night, and played, filling in for the regular band. We got finished up, and the guy there says, y'all can just leave your stuff where it is. It'll be okay tonight. So we took our instruments, fortunately, loaded them in, and went back home. To Newnan, where we were all, that's where we started with Newnan, even though we live in Peachtree City now. Newnan was where we started the thing out. Saturday afternoon, our regular bass player couldn't go back with us for some reason, and Donnie Lee went down to play bass with us. We drove into Country's Barbecue about 5 o'clock that afternoon to find a stack of ashes. The place had burned to the ground the night before after we all left.
Yeah.
And we
with your sound system.
Every piece of sound equipment we owned, about a couple of boxes of albums, our band rug, which we carried with us, and our band ashtray all burned up.
All melted to the floor.
We went in and saw it, and, you know, there was nothing salvageable. We had no insurance. The guy's insurance wouldn't cover it, so we were all of a sudden out about $3,000 that we invested in a sound system. Fortunately, we had a little cash, and we started talking about, well, we got to get another system if we're going to go on. That was fall. I can figure it up. It was fall either of 80 or 81. And we, just by coincidence, between the time our sound system burned and the time we bought the new one, we were playing at Blue Ridge, Gene Cox Festival. Well, Ted's wife had been a friend. His wife and my wife had worked together for a dentist in Peachtree City, and they were friends. Ted had never, this ought to go in a magazine, Ted was into disco dancing at the time. I haven't been to his house. Ted Lally was into disco dancing.
Bill, if you've monitored this, make sure you get this in.
Ted was heavy into disco dancing when I met him the first time. Well, this was a year or so later, and he and his wife were camping at Vogel State Park, and they called my house that week and said, we saw in the paper there's a bluegrass festival up at Blue Ridge, and we're going to be camping up there, and we'd just like to come out and see what it's all about. So that Friday night, it was cold as a well digger's destination. And we got to Blue Ridge, and there sit Ted and Brenda. Sure enough, you know, I hadn't seen them in a couple of years. I'd only met them once, but went out and sat down with them because Ted's wife and my wife were friends. I was being cordial. And I sat down, and the first thing Ted starts telling me is what's wrong with his sound system. It sounded pretty good to me. But I had been to his home, and I knew that he had a wall in his living room, which was nothing but sound gear. I mean, he graduated Georgia Tech, and his main interest was in sound systems, and he knew it from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to him, and I said, well, boy, I wish you'd tell me what you know, because we're fixing to buy a new system. In fact, this was on Saturday. Excuse me. I said, we're going Monday to look and probably buy a new sound system. Well, he just said, well, be sure you get blah, blah, blah. And that was all, and we left there, and I thought never to see Ted Lally again. Sunday night, he called my house and said, you know, I've been thinking about it. If y'all want me to, I'll go with you tomorrow when you go to buy that new sound system and be sure y'all get what you need. I said, well, you'll be welcome. you come. We would love to have you because we don't really know what we need, and we're going to get sold something by the people at the music store. So we meet at Rhythm City in Atlanta Monday night. Jack Spence is waiting on us, well-known bluegrass personage, whatever Jack, whatever you say about Jack. And Ted goes in there and starts throwing out all his knowledge about it and picks out just about what we need, you know, what he thinks we ought to have for what we're doing. And we commit that night by the sound system that we've got today with a few additions, which has served us well for 5 years. It wound the offshoot of it was at Rhythm City offered Ted a job selling sound equipment. And when I asked him, because I wasn't sure that he was nothing but bull, and I got Jack Spence apart, and I said, Jack, does this boy know what he's talking about? I said, I just really met him, and does he really know what he's talking about? And what Jack Spence told me was, well, you can know too much. So we knew then that he was on to something, and he knew what he was doing. So Ted helped us buy the sound equipment, which probably Eddie could have set up with some training. Agreed, we were playing. We were playing in Callaway Gardens. It was a much more complicated system.
It's like running a cockpit of a B-29.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot more complicated than what we had had in the past. So we were concerned. We were playing at Callaway Gardens about 2 or 3 weeks later. Ted said, I'll come down there and help you set it up and familiarize you with it. And he's been with us ever since.
Okay.
That's the long version.
From all of that, what advice would you give an aspiring group that was going to go out and purchase a sound system?
Take Ted with you.
No.
Take Ted with you. Okay.
Take Ted. And here we go. But take Ted or find someone who knows bluegrass music and what the needs of a bluegrass band are. So that
First of all, a person at a music store,
they don't really
know what a bluegrass band needs or what they want to sound like. And to them, everything's just totally electric, and you know, and that's what they're going to attempt to sell them. Mm-hmm. So unless you've got someone there that knows the equipment and knows what your capabilities are and knows what the group's potential is, you know, you're liable to wind up with the wrong stuff, something you're unhappy with.
Take someone who knows bluegrass and sound systems.
That's right.
Okay, good. Eddie, I was going to ask you what inspired you toward bluegrass, but I believe we've already answered that. In your first instrument. I didn't know I had these questions separated here. And you met Mike somewhere about 1977?
Late 77.
October. I believe it was October, but I can't swear to the month.
Yeah, was it at the Louisville Festival?
No. Well, the first meeting was at my house, trailer.
As the practice session?
Just the practice session.
That was my tryout.
That was the first tryout of Mike's. We had called him over to see what was going to happen.
It was desperate. I had seen them at Bullsboro play. I'd seen Eddie play with one band and him and Joe play with their band, but they didn't know me from Adam's house yet.
Aside from the regular bluegrass festivals, what noteworthy gigs have y'all played, say, beginning back a few years ago? Not only what noteworthy gigs have you played, but what's your most significant booking that you've had?
How much of that do you want to tackle? How much of it do you want me to tackle?
Just give me a couple of noteworthy gigs for the record.
We've done a couple of things that we're kind of proud of. We had the privilege just in March of this year, Jack, of playing the Kissimmee Bluegrass Festival in Kissimmee, Florida.
That's K-I-S-S-I-M-M-E-E.
And that in itself was an accomplishment, because that was as far from home as we had played, I guess. That was as far as we had traveled in our 8 years. That's what we've agreed on is our limit. It was a really large, well-organized, and well-run festival, and we were proud to be there. But the highlight of it was when on Saturday night we were backstage after having done our show, just standing around mingling, and Bill Monroe was about to go on. And he started just fooling with his mandolin and playing a couple little tunes and saying, y'all know what this is? And we were just bantering back and forth. And he said, well, y'all sing this song with me. I heard y'all sing in harmony on stage, and you done good. So sing this with me. And he did a song called Farther On that I have never heard before and have never heard anybody but him do. I heard him do it once since then. And we were just backstage, you know, humming it because we didn't even know the words. and thought that that was really fantastic that we sang with Bill Monroe backstage. But when Bill hit the stage about the fourth song he did, he said he was going to do one that he'd written that he didn't do much, and he'd like them boys that were singing backstage with him to come on stage and sing with
him.
Well,
I'll be done.
And all five of us, including the sound man, we run up each other's back to get on stage and suffered through singing harmony with Bill Monroe. And that's definitely noteworthy. That's the highlight of my career anyway. If he's got something he wants to add to that.
I definitely think that was pretty much the highlight.
How about, let's look at it in a financial situation. What is the most financially rewarding booking you ever had? And you don't need to tell me how much money you made, but just what was the most financially rewarding booking you've ever had?
We'll do some dreaming on this one.
Well, off the tape, Warner Robins probably was, but I don't think we need to say that.
I wouldn't like that on the record.
Okay.
Probably, in fact. Well, what would you say?
Would you care to tell me, instead of the booking or the festival, tell me what's the most money you made on a booking? Would that be
maybe that would be without listing a name of a place.
Yeah.
Maybe so. We have brought in as much.
Reason I want to ask is because a lot of us other bluegrass folks, we wonder how we stand, we have to compare ourselves to you guys that are.
Well, this one called Bull Feathers, this one I'll give you the figure, is an exception. There's been some hard feelings over it, but we have brought in as much as $2,200 in a week, in a 3-day weekend. Well, 4-day, really, 4-day weekend. But those people who offered us that and then paid us that for doing the job, and I mean, they offered us that. Will you do it for this? Now have hard feelings that we charged them that much.
Was it down south?
Yes.
Okay, because sometimes you can go way up north and draw a figure like that that's very unusual, but they take into consideration traveling and all that.
Off the record, those people will never pay us that again.
Well, that was a
nice chunk of change. But now you understand that's playing and running sound. I mean, that's a total.
Yeah, that was a total package. Yeah, we running sound for 3 days and played festival.
We ran Gopher.
Okay, in other words, people that are out here playing bluegrass festivals or at small bookings or whatever can expect anything, from zero to the sky's the limit, really.
Yeah.
It's whatever they can market there.
Whatever the market will allow.
Yeah.
And you have to know.
Yeah, there's nothing they can base anything on.
No,
yeah.
that's unusual.
But still, that shows that it can be made, doesn't it?
Well, it can be made.
Now, let's get into some of the cassettes and albums that you've recorded. How many have you recorded?
Completed two.
Two? All right, give me the name of the first one.
The name of the first one was Brush Fire, Joe, Eddie, Mike, and Gary.
That was kind of a subtitle.
Brush Fire, and that was Joe, Eddie,
Mike, and Gary.
The actual title of it, I guess, was Joe, Eddie, Mike, and Gary. We decided that was just kind of an informal title for the album after fighting over what to name it.
And that, what year was that?
81. It was late 80 and early 80. Well, early 81 when we finished. I guess we finished it in February 81.
February 81.
And who did that? Who published that?
It was recorded at Jasmine Sound Studio.
Jasmine.
It wasn't actually on the label. We just did our own marketing.
We put it on the Brush Fire label. It was totally independent. Jasmine Studios in Newnham.
And that's Newnham, Georgia?
Mm-hmm. That was Gary Sykes, by the way, that was playing bass on that. We haven't talked about any of that before.
I'll get to that later. What was the second one you did?
It's called Way Down Deep in My Soul.
And that was done where?
That was done at Real to Real Recording Studio.
To get technical, it was actually recorded at Jasmine, and then because of a problem with Jasmine, it was taken to Real to Real and mixed and parts re-recording. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you
it was put out on reel-to-reel label.
It was put out on a brush fire label.
It wasn't really on a label, but that's the
reel-to-reel was ultimately responsible for the sound, even
though they're at Newton.
They're at Stockbridge.
Stockbridge.
What happened at Jasmine was that we recorded it and paid him half of the printing fees and everything. You know, we got screwed. That's what we got. Mm. And after 8 weeks and him telling us it was going to be back any time, that he'd been to Atlanta and heard the master and it sounded great and it'd be back pressed any time, we called the people who he said was pressing it and they'd never heard of us or him. And he had, what we suspect is that he had spent our $1,200, because when we found that out on Monday morning, I had the day off. It was a state holiday, and I went to his house and got him out of the shower, threatened his existence.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to town, borrowed $1,200, which is what we had paid him for pressing, borrowed $1,200 at the bank and gave it back to me along with our tapes and our artwork, and we were back at square one. And that's when we went to reel to reel.
And then you're working on a new album now?
Presently working on the third one,
which is untitled at this point.
It doesn't have a name and probably won't be finished till early spring.
Spring of 1986. Have you found it easy? This is a kind of a question that applies to people that are interested in these things. Me for one. Have you found it easy or hard to sell or market your records at festivals? And what do you attribute this ease or hardness to?
Well,
or is it mediocre or what? You know?
Out of the shows that we do, if you're taking into consideration the type of shows that we do, the festivals are the easiest to market to records. I guess that's due to the fact that, you know, you're there, you're with a bluegrass crowd there. It gets easier to market it at a bluegrass festival than it is a nightclub
or an arts and crafts festival
or, say, some private party or something of that nature.
What it requires, you know, all it requires at a festival is just to set up a table and make them available. Obviously, we've had more luck or have been more successful selling our albums at festivals which featured semi-professional groups than we have at festivals that had six professional bands on the bill. You know, if we go to a festival that has Doyle Lawson, Bill Monroe, Bill Harrell, and Sonny and Bobby Osborne,
we'll sell them. So, in other words, you're probably not going to
sell them. We're going to sell no albums. That's the bottom line.
So, you usually sell more at the local talent festivals.
Right.
Overall, we have been very pleased at what we've been able to sell. You know, the numbers are not significant, but for us, we feel that we've been fortunate to sell.
When you cut your first or second record, did you put, say, 400 or 500 copies of it?
The first one was 1,000.
The first one, we printed 1,000 copies.
And have you sold about all those?
We have sold about all of them now, but we reduced the price in order to do that.
Yeah.
We have sold about as many of them over a five-year period since it came out in 81, we sold more of them. Let's see. We got 500 of the second one, let me say that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have sold almost the majority of the 500 of
would
the second one.
Would you recommend to an aspiring group that's going to cut their first record that they shouldn't maybe cut over 500 or 250 or 300?
I'd say 500 maximum.
Maximum and less if they can get a good price break. But the price breaks, generally, what we found is they start at 500.
Yeah.
We went ahead and had 1,000 jackets printed up on our second one because while they were printing, they could run off 1,000 for a little. And there's 500 jackets stored away in North Atlanta somewhere that we may never fill up, but we paid for in anticipation of someday, you know, getting the albums out.
Hmm.
It's just important that you understand from the presser where the price breaks are.
Yeah. But, so don't go overboard on your first cut.
Don't expect to sell from from our experience, don't expect to sell over 500.
Until you get a real good name, it's just awful hard to sell that 500. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What are your long range aspirations of Brushfire as a group? What's your big plans for the future?
You want to ask
me? That's a tough question, Matt. I don't know. I don't guess we never really set any limitations as far as what the group's going to be able to do.
No limitations, right?
What I say when people that I know ask me, you know, well, God, y'all going to reach a point where you're going to give up your jobs and go full time? We don't have any aspirations to go full time because we're realistic.
Okay, you're going to remain semi-professional then?
We're going to remain, yes. Definitely will remain that.
We would like to go as far as